G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on Truth to You. That's truth number two, letter U.org. And joining me is Ira Michelson. G'day, my friend.
Who are you, Jono?
Job chapter 35. Here we are. And Ellie, who continues on, begins, in my version, it begins with the word moreover. I like the word moreover. I don't get to use it that often. And when I do get to use it, it makes me feel smart.
I don't know that there's any more over in Hebrew, but okay, if it makes you happy.
It does. Moreover, Elihu answered and said, "Do you think this is right? Do you say my righteousness is more than God's? For you say, what advantage will it be to you? What profit shall I have more than if I had sinned?" Now, did Job actually say, I mean, has he really implied that his righteousness is more than God's?
Well, I mean, this is the argument or perspective that we've been bringing for the last couple of weeks, in that when you look at verse 2, from my perspective, you could translate it as, do you think this to be just to say, I am right against God? If we look at Job chapter 10, in verse 15 through 17, it says, "If I am guilty, woe to me. If I am in the right, I cannot lift up my head, for I am filled with disgrace and look on my affliction.
Mm-hmm.
Were my head lifted up, you would hunt me like a lion and again work wonders against me. You renew your witnesses against me and increase your vexation toward me. You bring fresh troops against me." So this is Job speaking to God there.
Okay, so hang on. So the way you read it was, I am right against God. So that's different than saying my righteousness is more than God's. I don't think that's what Job's saying, but I can see the way you put it makes more sense. He's saying, I haven't done anything wrong, but surely God has made a mistake here, or something. His justice hasn't prevailed here because I'm suffering and yet I'm innocent.
Right.
Okay, so that's fair enough. All right.
Yeah, we have to put it back within the framework of the divine council, the heavenly court.
Mm-hmm.
He's basically saying that I'm in the right here against God. If I'm litigating a case against God, I'm right here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. And he goes on to say, "I will answer you and your companions with you. Look to the heavens and see, and behold, the clouds are higher than you. If you sin, what can you accomplish against him? Or if your transgressions are multiplied, what do you do to him? Or, you know, if you're righteous, what do you give him, or what does he receive from your hand?" That's a really good question. There's nothing, I mean, there's really nothing that we can do that harms God, no matter what our sin is. There's nothing that we can do that harms him. In the same way, whatever righteousness we achieve, whatever good we do, how does it benefit him?
Well, you know, there's something that I see in verse 6, and that's the difference between two different words that are used here for this concept of to do, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a difference between these two words. In the first case, we have im chatata ma tifa'al, that word tifa'al, but it says tifa'al bo. You know, what do I do to him? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
In the second part of the verse, it says, V'arabu fisha'echa ma ha'aseh. Okay? Which also, the verb, to do. And we see this verb used 57 times, many of them, or most of them, with God as the subject. And 26 times we see it in Psalms, and 12 times we see it in Job here. And it's distinguished from the second part of the verse, which is used in elevated and poetic style. So basically, do you think that if you had sinned, that you would affect God in some adverse way? Is basically the way we would translate this, based on the use of those two different verbs there.
So that's a fair question. What is the answer to that? I mean, does God feel pain when we do something terribly wrong? Is he overjoyed when we do something wonderfully right?
Well, I mean, I think what Elihu is trying to get here is that, you know, that neither in your transgression, you know, if we look at verse 7, if you're righteous, what do you give to him? First, it talks about sinning. You know, what do you do if you sin? And then we see in verse 7, if you're righteous, what do you give to him, or what does he receive from your hand? So he's basically making the argument to Job that neither in your transgression nor in your righteousness do you affect God one way or the other.
Okay.
Really, I think what he's really trying to do is he's really trying to say that his effect is in the natural and not in the spiritual.
So he goes on in verse 8, your wickedness affects a man such as you, and your righteousness a son of man. Now, is that just an expression, a Hebrew expression, to say a man such as you, a son of man? Is there something in that, or?
Son of man in this context just means a human being, a mortal. And he's making, that's why I'm telling you, he's making a distinction between the heavenly and the natural realm.
Okay. Fair enough.
Basically, this is the answer to the two previous versions, that your actions only affect you and other human beings.
Fair enough. Because of the multitude of oppressions, they cry out. They cry out for help because of the arm of the Almighty. But no one says, where is God my Maker, who gives songs in the night, who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth, and makes us wiser than the birds of the heaven? What's that about? I mean, I have to admit, I've never heard someone cry that out.
I know. This is a very interesting two chapters. And there's a lot of blanks, almost, that we have to fill in here, or we have to attempt to fill in. And we try to do the best we can with this. You know, this crying out that's spoken of in verse 9 is actually said to be a plaintive cry. It's like a mournful or sorrowful cry.
Mm-hmm.
A plaintive cry is described as, you know, the cry of like a wounded animal. And so, you know, I was looking at some of the commentaries on this, and one commentator claims that the reason why God occasionally deals severely with the righteous is because, obviously, their victims cry out, or the victims' cries outweigh their own cries. However, when we look at the next verse, it doesn't support that notion. The second explanation is that simply that God sometimes does not listen to the cry of the righteous, and mm-hmm. that makes people feel uncomfortable. But when we see, and none say, where is God my Maker who gives songs in the night, this is really speaking of the wicked oppressors who neither seek God nor sing his praises. And that's why I think we may not deal with it tonight, but we're going to see, you know, at the end of verse 36, I mean, end of chapter 36, I'm sorry, we're going to see a song that Ellie sings that we'll probably deal in the next segment of the show on. But,
sure.
I think that this is connected in that way, because he's making a distinction between the two. And we can really connect what's being said here with the end of 36 when we get to that. So when he goes on to say, who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth and makes us wiser than the birds of the heavens, what I believe is being said here is that these oppressors are like the animals, because they do not seek the wisdom that has been made available to mankind by God.
Okay. So 12, it goes on to say, there they cry out, but he does not answer, because of the pride of evil men. Surely God will not listen to empty talk, nor will the Almighty regard it. Although you say you do not see him, yet justice is before him, and you must wait for him. And now, because he has not punished in his anger, nor taken much notice of folly, therefore Job opens his mouth in vain, and he multiplies words without knowledge. I don't know what to make of all of that. It's a bit, it seems a little disjointed to me.
Well, I mean, you know, like I said, these are not easy chapters. Elihu's speeches can be quite difficult. And when we see this idea of this concept of him making a distinction between the heavenly and the natural, and then we go into this whole distinction that's made between the righteous and the evil, in crying out to God, he brings up the arrogance of the arrogance of evil men. And Elihu is going to argue that Job has no right to expect immediate answers from God.
I was just going to say, if I listen to, if Elihu was talking to me, and, particularly in the latter half of chapter 35, I'd be sitting there thinking, dude, I don't know what you're talking about. What are you talking about? And I'd have to sit down and really try and iron it out and discuss it with him and try and figure out exactly what his point is. And yet in 36, he begins by proclaiming himself very assertively, very positively, and very sure.
So I think when we look at this, when we look at these last few verses of 35, you know, when we consider that Elihu has been chiding Job for undermining the simple faith of the bystanders, remember we talked about that?
That's
one of the things he rebuked him for. We can see here that he is accusing Job of more guilt than what he's being punished for. Okay? That God has actually averted his eyes from Job for some of his transgressions. And the guilt is not the guilt that the friends, again, that the friends accused him of, but it's the guilt of his attitude towards God. That really he brought guilt upon himself afterwards. That, yeah, he might have been righteous, and God might have called him righteous and perfect and without blame, but then he suddenly thought that, you know, he was, and I know people are not going to like this either, but there's almost an entitlement that Elihu is rebuking him for. That somehow you think that because you cry out to God, that God has to stop everything he's doing and answer you. And now you open your mouth with empty words without knowledge and multiply these words.
I know, but I find myself thinking along the side, like I understand what Elihu is pointing out. He's pointing out the sovereignty of God and that God is not obligated to him, regardless of his actions, whether good or bad. God is not obligated to him, and that God is sovereign and can do what he wants and is still more righteous than Job and still more powerful than Job. But then, like, I think that, you know, about the fact that God has declared Job to be a blameless and righteous and upstanding and upright person. And then we look at, it makes me think of Deuteronomy chapter 28 in the Torah. It talks about the blessings and the curses. And, you know, if you do this, 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 and you disobey me here and you disobey me there, then this is going to happen to you and it's going to be terrible things. But if you obey my voice and listen to my words and obey everything that I say, then it's all going to be good with you and you'll be the head and not the tail and you know, everything will be fine. Wonderful chapter to read through. But these are the struggles that I deal with when I think of how Elihu is dealing with Job and the things that he's saying.
Look, I understand that. And I understand that this is probably, we've said this on many occasions, that this is probably one of the most difficult books in the entire Hebrew Bible to try and decipher and to make sense of. We're not that what we're saying is absolutely perfect in the absolute understanding of it, because there are scholars that are far more knowledgeable than you and I, Jonah, that have tried to make sense of this. But we're doing the best that we can with the material that we have, with my understanding of Hebrew, you know, with our understanding of context and so forth. I don't think it would be wise to discount looking at some of these other perspectives and to make sense of why Elihu would say the things he says, why God is not answering Job and so forth. It's very easy to fall into the trap of feeling bad for Job. And we should. I mean, look, the guy had incredible suffering. But I was looking today on Facebook, in a group that I was in. The administrator asked the question, who do you admire as a character in the Tanakh? And somebody brought up Job, and they said, oh, but he suffered, and he still, you know, maintained his faith and trust in God. And I chuckled to myself, because I said to myself, well, they've obviously never listened to Treasures from the Tanakh. Because, you know, of course, we bring a different perspective to that. And I'm not saying that Job is a bad guy, but at the same time, I'm saying that of course, we're going to have an answer from God himself at some point here.
Mm-hmm. Looking at different perspectives, Ira, and entertaining the possibility that maybe Job isn't, that he's at fault here and there, and perhaps this is the reason, and so on and so forth. Here's a different perspective of Elihu. What if Elihu is a young, well-meaning person who does more harm than good? What if he's just a young, well-meaning, passionate, zealous, believes that he has the right answer, and is standing up to have his say in the midst of great men, that he himself is proud in some respects. Well, is that a possibility?
Well, then my question to you would be, and this would be taking it much farther forward into the text, my question would be, then why did God not rebuke Elihu, and why was Job not required to bring sacrifice on behalf of Elihu, and only the three friends?
That's a really good question, and we will deal with that. But that's a good question. That's true. But I mean, it doesn't help, though, when Elihu begins chapter 36 with this. It says he also proceeded and said, "Bear with me a little, and I will show you that that there are yet words to speak on God's behalf." He claims to be speaking on God's behalf. "I will fetch my knowledge from afar. I will ascribe righteousness to my Maker, for truly my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you." Is he referring to himself there? Because he speaks about God.
Yeah.
He says that he's got words to speak on God's behalf. So he claims to be speaking on God's behalf. He also says, "I will ascribe righteousness to my Maker." Then he says, "One who is perfect." Now, is that "one who is perfect"? Do you think he's talking about himself, or do you think he's talking about God? "One who is perfect in knowledge is with you, Job." God is with you. Is that what he's saying? Or is he saying, "I'm here speaking with you, and I'm perfect in knowledge"?
Well, I don't think so. I think because, you know, what I translate this as, and actually I don't always like the JPS translation, but, you know, verse 4 in the English, "I have, for truly my words do not lie, one with perfect knowledge is with you." JPS, in the first part, has "a man of sound opinions," for truly, you know.
Well, I can deal with that. A man of sound opinions, that's something I can accept. But "one who is perfect in knowledge," I think, you young upstart. You know?
I don't think he's referring to himself there. I think what he's doing is saying, you know, "I'm a man of sound opinions, but one with perfect knowledge is with you." And remember, we can't forget also that we've discussed in previous chapters the fact that Job has asked for a mediator, okay? Mm-hmm. And that we spoke a few chapters ago that it's very clear at the end of, I want to say chapter 32 or 33, that we made the argument that Elihu is in fact saying that he is that mediator that you called upon. And so it would not be unusual for him to say that he's going to be speaking on behalf of God here. You ask
okay.
the mediator, you have it.
All right, fair enough. But then, I have to admit, I have some italics in this next line. This is what it says: "Behold, God is mighty, but despises no one." Now, "no one" is in italics. What does it say? Now, I'm just looking over now in the new JPS at verse 5, and it says, "See, God is mighty, he is not contemptuous." Well, it says a totally different thing, Ira.
And neither one of those are correct.
what do you got?
"Behold, God is mighty and does not reject."
And does not, again, I can deal with that. That I can deal with, because I can think of plenty of people throughout the Tanakh that God has despised.
Right. He is mighty okay. in strength and heart.
He is mighty in strength and understanding. You've got mighty in strength and heart?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, that's the literal. It says, kaber koach lev, and lev is heart.
Heart, yeah. "He does not preserve the life of the wicked, but gives justice to the oppressed. He does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous, but they are on the throne with kings." Is that right? "For he has seated them forever."
Yeah,
they are exalted.
Yeah, "he does not withdraw or reduce his eyes from the righteous, but with kings on the throne he seats them forever, and they are exalted." And
okay.
So basically what he's saying is, and this goes along with what we read in 35, that in essence his providence is benign. Meaning that he does not treat the poor or lowly any different than the righteous or kings upon their throne.
Right. Okay, that's fair enough. "And if they are bound in fetters, held in the cords of affliction, then he tells them their work and their transgression, that they have acted defiantly. And he also opens their ears to instruction and commands that they turn from iniquity. And if they obey and serve him, then they shall spend their days in prosperity and their years in pleasure. But if they do not obey," Ira, "then it says that they shall perish by the sword, and they shall die as one without knowledge." But isn't that, now, we go back and forth on this, because again, this sounds kind of similar to what you read in Deuteronomy 28.
Mm-hmm.
But Elihu seems to be jumping back and forth between these two declarations, that God punishes the ones that the wicked, and those that are wicked will perish, those that sin defiantly, but the ones who are obedient, well, they will be prosperous, they will have pleasures, and so on and so forth. Are we hopping back and forth?
Yeah, in essence, because again, he's dealing with the two different types of people. But he's also trying to make the argument that there's the occasional time that the tzaddik, that the righteous one, is exposed to suffering. And then in actually, I would say from verse 9 on, actually through to verse 17, he begins to give an answer to this. And so, you know, when we read on, like in verse 9, then he declares to them their work and their transgressions are excessive. In a way, what we are about to read seems no different than what we have heard before.
Mm-hmm.
Eliphaz in Job chapter 5, starting in verse 16, says, "So the poor have hope and injustice shuts her mouth. Behold, blessed is the one whom God reproves, therefore despise not the discipline of the Almighty. For he wounds, but he binds up, he shatters, but his hands heal." You know, then we see Bildad in Job chapter 8, verse 5 and 6 says, "If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you're pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation." And then so far in Job 11, 13 and 14 says, "If you prepare your heart, you will stretch out your hands towards him. If iniquity is in your head, put it far away and let not injustice dwell in your tents."
Mm-hmm.
Basically, Elihu now begins to explain that there may be many different reasons for suffering in the world, and each of them is grounded in the absolute justice of God.
All right. Okay. And it goes on to say in 13, "But the hypocrites in heart store up wrath. They do not cry for help when he binds them. They die in youth, and their life ends among the perverted person. He delivers the poor in their affliction and opens their ears in oppression."
You know, it's interesting. In verse 14, we have one of those situations with the reverse. You know, if you look at verse 14, it's really interesting because, the you know, just as a side note, you know, the last word there is Bakideshim, you know, which normally be translated as holy. So they die in youth and their life ends among the, what do you have? Is among the what?
It says they die in youth and their life ends among the perverted person.
The depraved, or actually some translations have it, or among the cult prostitutes.
Really?
Yeah.
What has it got in my new JPS? It says they expire among the depraved, yeah. Mm. But they do not cry for help, Ira.
Right.
That's pride, right? That's a reflection of pride.
Absolutely.
Okay.
He delivers the afflicted in their affliction, and he uncovers their heirs with oppression. And indeed, he draws you out from the mouth of distress to a broad place where there is no constraint. And what was set on your table was full of fatness. So it's talking about, you know, a table laid out with rich food.
Did you just say that he uncovers their heirs?
I did.
Is that some kind of strange American accented thing?
Yeah.
Some heirs on your head?
You know what it
is? Is it because he's talking about heirs without the H again? You're not using the H? Going on?
Sometimes with words, it's me. It's the way I speak. For some reason, later in life, I don't know why this happens, but words that have E-A-R-S in them, somehow my mouth will not pronounce it the proper way.
That's one of the weirdest things I've ever heard in my life. Are you serious?
It is very weird because...
Are you telling me you have a selective speech impediment that you've developed later in life?
I'm saying that. It's like, for instance, If you the word, I don't even want to say it because it's going to come out wrong. Word, if you take the word spelled B E E R, and the word
beer,
B E.
Don't tell me you can't say beer. If you go to the pub and order, you're going to order me a bear.
But that's the thing. Sometimes, but sometimes when it's spelled B E A R, I pronounce beer.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's like comes out weird.
So if we go walking in the woods and you yell out, "Look, a beer," and I get all excited, that's not a good thing, right?
Good thing. So I have to like really take time to stop and think about what I'm saying so I can make the distinction between bear and beer. See, I do that. So when I said, and he uncovers their ears, crashing.
You can do it.
You can do it, but I have to do it slowly. Otherwise, the Ikean covers their ears. You know? I don't know what to tell you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Oh, that's not nice.
No, but it's just that you said as and then you said it again, and I thought, hang on. Is this some strange thing like in America where you say herbs and not herbs? I mean, you know, it's possible.
Well, you
but
know,
no, it's just you.
Yeah, so now all the time, Lori and I go to the store. We need to pick up some herbs.
Herbs. That's good.
Jono might be listening, and we don't want to say herbs.
No, I'm glad I'm having a positive impact.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sorry, returning to verse 16. Indeed, he would have brought you out of dire distress into the broad place where there is no restraint, and what is set on your table would be full of richness. Indeed, he would have done that? What's he suggesting here in 16?
That's really interesting that you asked that, because the only thing that I can make out for me is that possibly, and I'm saying possibly, this could be describing Gehinnom and the deliverance from it. And
okay.
What he's trying to describe is that the suffering of the righteous in this world will save them from Gehinnom, and they will enjoy the bliss of the Olam Haba, the world to come.
But he's saying he would have brought you out. Indeed, he would have. And that's always, he would have done that if what? If Job had said, God is righteous, I don't know why I'm in this situation, but he knows what he's doing, he is sovereign, and praise be to the Almighty, and then what? God would have brought him out of that? Is that what Elihu was suggesting?
But he brought you from the mouth of distress. He draws you out from the mouth of distress to a broad place where there is no constraint. I mean, Gehinnom is a place of distress and restraint or constraint. But he's saying, you know, he does the opposite. He'll draw you out from there. So that's why I'm saying that it could be him describing deliverance from Gehinnom.
You know, it might be by my feeble brain trying to wrap my brain around Elihu's words, but he's starting to frustrate me, I have to admit.
It frustrates me too. You know, I'm the one that has to try and make sense of this.
But you are filled with the judgment due the wicked. Judgment and justice take hold of you because there is wrath. Beware lest he take you away with one blow, for a large ransom would not help you avoid it. I just kind of think, of course he's angry. Of course Job's angry. Doesn't Job deserve to be angry? I don't know.
So, you know, I mean, verse 17 I have translated, but you are full of judgment on the wicked. Judgment and justice seize you. But it could actually be translated as judgment and justice will be upheld. Okay? That could be a very likely translation of this.
And okay.
See, Elihu turns his attention back to Job. Because really he's talking to the audience there. But he's really not talking specifically to Job. He's just making generalizations about the righteous and the wicked. Because remember, he says, I'll talk to you and those around. But now it seems like he turns his attention back to Job. And he's basically telling him that if you are righteous, then you have nothing to worry about. And your suffering will be that which saves you from the fate of the wicked. Like, in other words, don't think that you're suffering the same fate as the wicked are suffering. If you're really righteous, you have nothing to worry about. You'll be delivered from the... you know, the mouth of distress. Because he goes on in the next to say, but beware lest wrath entice you into scoffing, in verse 18, and let not the greatness of the ransom or the bribery turn you aside. What's interesting here is that the word in 18, besefek, which is the, you know, in there, actually means clapping, where it's translated scoffing.
Mm-hmm.
The word is actually clapping. And so what it's talking about is that, you know, this is obviously something that would have taken place in biblical times, that was related to that. But when we look at this, when we look at what Elihu is saying, as much as we try to avoid issues like this, we can't ignore what Elihu is describing is suffering for our good. In other words, we all look to the greater reward being our deliverance from the suffering.
Mm-hmm.
We're thinking that the reward is our suffering because of what it might accomplish in us.
Because of the maturity that it will accomplish, right? This is what it's. I mean, if we look at it that way, then we can say that the suffering of the wicked leads to their destruction. The suffering of the righteous leads to their maturity. Can we say that?
We could. And remember, we talked about the man Ish Gamzu, you know,
mm-hmm.
back in all of the suffering he went through, and his students asking him about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is one of the things that we see, and I think what Elihu is trying to get across here is instead, we, like Job, look to squander the experience. All we want to do is cry out to God, and we want to be delivered from the suffering and be relieved from the suffering. We don't want to elevate ourselves or learn or, like you say, mature.
Mm. So that I can deal with, Ira. That's a harsh, harsh thing to come to grips with. But I understand what you're saying there, and I think that that's certainly a possibility. And in any case, so verse 19, it says, "Will your riches or all the mighty forces keep you from distress? Do not desire the night when people are cut off from their place. Take heed, do not turn to iniquity, for you have chosen this rather than affliction." Chosen this, chosen what?
Well, first I think we need to, first I just want to talk about the previous two verses for a second. You know, when you're talking about wealth and things like that, where he says, "Do not long for the night when peoples vanish in their place," and mm-hmm. it's interesting that it's peoples, that it's actually plural, where it says "amim," because there's many great examples of the nations that lived in extreme wealth with great success that have disappeared.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. True.
You look at that. You know, even in a modern day, when we look back on places like Rome and Greece and so forth and everything else,
mm-hmm.
they've all ceased to exist. A desire to live a pain-free life sets you up to end up like them, okay? So when we look at the next verse, "Keep watch lest you turn to iniquity, for this you have chosen rather than affliction," or rather than submission.
Mm-hmm.
We could do that as well. So Elihu reminds him that he has chosen a belligerent attitude toward God rather than humble submission to his suffering.
Right. Okay, sure. Boy, it's hard. It's really hard. So we've got two more verses before I want to stop, because at verse 24, the tone changes in 24 of chapter 36 and continues right through to chapter 37. So we're going to do that next week. But the final two verses of the passage we're dealing with now, 22 and 23, it says, "Behold, God is exalted by his power. Who teaches like him? Who has assigned him this way? Or who has said, you have done wrong?"
Yeah, and, you know, that very much seems like certainly early on setting up for what we're actually going to hear from God down the road. And what I believe is that we see here at the end, him saying what he's saying now sets up for what I believe in verse 24 through the end is actually a song. It's an introduction to a song that Elihu will sing about God.
Mm.
I think that this is alluded to in a few of the verses that we'll see from 24 on, and of course we'll touch on that when we actually go through those verses.
So I think also, I just want to highlight that in 22, "Behold, God is exalted by his power, who teaches like him." And I think that's the key word, that Job is not being punished. But perhaps Elihu is trying to say to him, "You're not being punished, you're being taught."
Right.
Understand that you're being taught and stop declaring your righteousness and the injustice of God, because you need to come through this. This is where we're going?
Yeah, it's a very good point. I actually have, "Who is a teacher like him?"
Mm-hmm. Okay, that I can deal with.
"Who has appointed for him his way, or who can say, you have done wrong or you have done iniquity?" I mean, who can place that upon God? That's what he's being rebuked for, because that's what, you know, from Elihu's perspective, you're basically saying you're right and God's wrong.
Boy, it's hard. I still feel sorry for Job, but you know, it can't be disputed. Of course, we're studying it today, and that this story has lasted the ages.
It has, and, you know, look, we'll never know for sure the reality of this book. What I mean by that is, you know, there's going to be different opinions. Some people's opinions that it's such poetic language that it really is just a teaching tool for us to teach us about how to deal with suffering. Yeah. And there are those that believe that, you know, that that's true, but that this is also a legitimate story about a legitimate person. In a way, either way, it's not pleasant. It's not a pleasant lesson for us to learn, whether it's meant for us as a tool to learn about how to deal with suffering, or to actually see the suffering of a man if he was a real person, and to feel what we feel about him, and at the same time learn that the lesson is meant for us as well to learn on how to live with suffering.
Mm. And when you take that into consideration, Ira, really verses in that we know, such as the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, or the fear of God is the beginning of knowledge, how much more does Job give gravity to the phrase the fear of God, because he can do anything in his sovereignty regardless of our actions.
And this is one of the things that is so powerful about, you know, Hebraic concepts, or concepts that we see in Judaism related to the concept of faith. The fact that in Judaism we don't just have one word that encompasses the idea of faith and trust like you have in Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So the words emunah, which is typically translated as faith, and I don't really see that that really does justice to it. And then we have the Hebrew word for trust, which is bitachon. And basically these are concepts that are embedded in each other. There are people that have faith in God but don't trust God. And emunah is, it can really be determined, even for somebody who really has faith, let's say, emunah can be determined as the person who recognizes that God is sovereign, and the person who has bitachon, who has trust, is the person who not only sees that God is sovereign, but recognizes that everything that happens to them is meant for their good from God.
This too is for the best.
Right.
Yeah, that's the attitude to have. So next week, we're going to go from 24 all the way through to the end of 37, where Elihu proclaims the majesty of God. But there we are. That's where we're going to leave it. Now, Ira Michelson, again, the website is TorahThreads.com. If you haven't been there, go there, because it's a nice, shiny new website full of heaps of information. TorahThreads.com. Also find it on Facebook. Thank you again, my friend Ira Michelson, for coming back on The Truth to You.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure to have you. And until then, until next week, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's Word. Shalom.